Hi everyone, this is Chris Deasy. Welcome to yet another in my series of nostalgia interviews. And my guest this week is Allard Thomas. Now, Allard researches in the area of Scientology. He's working at the moment in Wolverhampton. He did his first degree at Trinity College, Carmarthen, where actually I worked a couple of years before Allard started out as a student. We actually only met for the first time in 2019 at a conference, in the days when physical conferences were to a penny. And it was so good to catch up with Allard because he talks in detail about his work with the Church of Scientology and the need for a researcher to be careful about how they control their work. He talks about his music obsessions as well, including Queen and Sparks, and why he thinks Sparks are everything that pop music should be. He even has one of their album logos tattooed on his arm. We talk about the thrill of buying vinyl. He talks about how he is kind of a frustrated musician. He'd love to produce bands, be a studio engineer, and at the very end of the interview, we discover why Allard is a looking forward kind of person. So join me, Chris Deasy, for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week is Allard Thomas. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have Allard Thomas as my latest nostalgia interview guest. Now, we've met, well, mainly once in person, but of course, we met a couple of times virtually, and we have a huge amount in common because it turns out that in different guises and at different times, we were both in the same institution in Trinity College, Carmarthen.
Yes, absolutely. My years there were between 2007 and 2010.
Yeah, because I was working there 2001 to 2004, so we would have just missed each other. But and you were there to do religious studies, is that right?
I was indeed, yes. The department at the time was run by Greg Barker, and the core team, there were a few guest lecturers and so on, but the core team were Greg Barker, Stephen Gregg, and Amjad Hussain, and they ran a tremendous department. It was really excellent.
Yeah, and of course I work with them all also in Lampeter. So as we were just saying before we started the interview, I spent the first 31 years of my life living in Wales from Cardiff originally. Then I went westwards. A lot of my school friends either stayed in Cardiff or went eastwards. I went the opposite way, and I stayed there for a very long time. But as we were just saying as well, you've also spent time in Kent, where I am living now. Am I right in thinking that originally you're from South Wales?
Yes, that's right. I swear I'm not following you around. I was born in Morriston, brought up in Carmarthenshire. My parents live in Llandeilo, so Carmarthen was very local to me when I went to university. So I was one of the local kids at the local university. I think Trinity very much appealed to a lot of local students. I think that was one of its strengths. So that worked out well for me.
Yeah, because when I was there, I was really conscious that whereas when I was at university myself in the early 90s, there were lots of students, and this was in the days when you got a full grant, and there were students from London, the Southeast, all over the UK. But yeah, Trinity was much more local. But actually, even now, when I work at Kent, a lot of students, not all, but many students are local-ish or they're from neighbouring counties. So I think it says something about the different ways that university education has changed, that you'd go on a full grant and you wouldn't see your family for 10 or 12 weeks. But these days, you know, living on campus is obviously something that a lot of our students do, but it's increasingly less the inevitable option. And when I was at Carmarthen, you're right, there were students from Carmarthen itself, from Swansea, loads from Swansea or from West Wales. So that was, it was very unusual. I think maybe there might be one or two, literally no more than that, students in each year group who are from England or Scotland.
Yeah, yeah. We had a few exchange students as well. The department ran an exchange scheme. That was really cool as well. But what I really liked about that department was while there was a very local community, so to speak, with a catchment, they were very much an international, forward-facing department, you know, so all three of the core team were doing great work. Interestingly, they were all finishing off their PhDs while I started. So they were juggling the teaching and getting their theses done. But they were all doing really interesting stuff, and they were all, top tier academics, great work. And that was inspiring. It kind of led me down the road that I'm on now. I don't know whether to thank them or to blame them.
Well, you see, it's funny, isn't it? Because we all have these mentors that we accumulate in our lives, and sometimes they can come from, say, the academic profession, or they can come from our school teachers, or they might come from media stars or sports people, people who inspire us, and we say, "I want to be like them. I want to be them when I'm older." And what I found certainly is that when you're studying under somebody, Paul Badham was somebody I worked with very closely when I was in Lampeter, and you inevitably find that even when you're teaching, you kind of a bit of that rubs off on you, and you're aware that when you're teaching, you're kind of inhabiting a certain role that you've maybe unconsciously studied, that you're aware that somebody's drive and determination, determination and dynamism is kind of something that then inspires you to go off and do the same kind of thing. So actually, if you've got three people doing PhDs, finishing off PhDs, and they're teaching you, they're both students and teachers at the same time. So you've actually got an awful lot in common with them. It's not quite the same as sometimes when you go at the age of 18 and you've got the 50 or 60-year-old lecturer who's been doing that same job for 30 or more years, and you just feel, completely in awe of them because they've been, you're just one of thousands of students that's my perception. That was my perception. But when you're meeting somebody who's, for example, doing the PhD, you kind of feel that they can understand where you're coming from, and you can understand where they're coming from because you're all sort of meeting deadlines, and it's kind of like a really nice learning community.
Yes. Well, we're all there to learn, and I like to emphasize that with my students as well. That I mean, by our very nature, academics don't stop learning, and I like conversation. So they definitely facilitated that. And when I started with them, my goal was to be an RE teacher. Which I obviously don't do now. I did do a PGCE straight after the degree, and very glad that I did. It was there that I met Victoria, whom I later married. But academia kept calling me back. So as soon as the PGCE was over, I just wanted to get back into reading and writing. So I jumped into my master's straight away, and then stuck with academia from there. So it's and that was never part of my plan when I was applying to go to Trinity. When I started in Trinity, I thought I would leave the university, do the PGCE and get a job as an RE teacher. But it's turned out completely differently.
Absolutely. And where did you do the master's? I know you did the PhD with the Open University.
That's right, yes. The master's was in Lampeter. But at this point, the merger, as all you need to say to people in Lampeter and Carmarthen, the merger, they know exactly what you mean. So in the early 2010s, for those who don't know, Trinity University College and University of Wales Lampeter merged. They were sister colleges anyway, weren't they? But there was a big merger, and it became what's now the University of Wales Trinity St David. And that's where I did my master's, but on the Lampeter campus. Sadly, part of being a master's student, I found, is that you rarely need to be on campus, with the exception of meeting a supervisor and so on, because there's so much more independent learning. I didn't have classes, so I didn't get that Lampeter experience that so many people talk about, that Victoria talks about. She was a Lampeter student from her BA to her MA. And everybody that went to Lampeter speaks about it so warmly and so fondly. And I can see why. I can see why, but I never had that experience myself.
Which MA did you do?
It was a bit of a wordy title: study of religions, colon, religious experience. Because I was really interested in the phenomena of religious experience at the time. And I do sometimes have to state study of religions, religious experience, because I think an MA in religious experience sometimes sounds like you've spent a year in a monastery. But it was from a religious studies perspective. So yeah, that's where I started developing some of my interests that I then thought, okay, I want to go and do this as a PhD.
Yeah, no, because mine was in death and immortality. And of course, it's actually the best title to give. But of course, I was always aware that when I was off Lampeter and people had never heard of the program, and people would say, so what are you doing? You're still a student. You've been a student for a long time. What are you doing these days? And you say, I'm looking at death and immortality. And of course, the look on people's faces would be like, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, oh, dear, you know, things got that desperate. But in a funny way, and I'm very keen to talk about your research in just a minute, but I always found that what would then happen is that that was a great impetus to say, well, why am I doing this? What can I do with it? And of course, my subsequent interest in film ended up being something that I could marry with all the death and immortality stuff. So I ended up writing about films about death and the afterlife. So that became an interesting kind of career move. And indeed, in terms of the teaching that I do now. So that's my point of reference. It's like using all the stuff I was taught at Lampeter and taking it forward and merging it with something that when I was in Lampeter as an undergraduate, we would never have considered studying. You know, we never did anything on film or theology in film. So it was really interesting to sort of try and say, well, having done that, I'm in, you know, quote, uniquely placed to deliver that. So all those years on, when people give me those very funny looks, they can still give me those funny looks, but at least I can say that it wasn't a literally a dead end.
Well, it does sound cool to say that you're a master of death and immortality.
Yeah,
and I think that's a cool title to have.
It is, but of course, also people expect you then to be able to offer counselling. And I've had many people who say, "Well, I've been at funerals," and they say, "So what happens now?" And of course, it's in a sense a serious point, because if you've studied it to that degree, they don't want you just to say, "Well, I looked at this model and that model, a Hebraic model and a Greek model. I've looked at mind dependent worlds and near death experiences." They actually want you to be able to give an answer. You know, what happens when I die? And of course, that's not quite what I'm qualified to do, but I'm able to certainly articulate some of the different possibilities. And I think that is, I think, comforting for a lot of people that you're aware of some of those big overarching questions. But in your case, am I right in thinking that it's Scientology that has become your research focus?
Yes, my death and immortality is Scientology. Now, this again stems back to my time in Trinity. I went on a field trip to New York, organized by Greg, Jed and Stephen. And part of that field trip was a whole day that we spent in the Church of Scientology, which at the time was quite remarkable. The Church of Scientology had been quite open to having undergrads groups and cohorts come in recent years. But at the time, it was quite a big deal that, you know, we took about 40 students out to go to the Church of Scientology. It was quite unheard of at that point, I think. It was fascinating. It was absolutely fascinating, because at that point, you know, my favorite subject in school was RE. And of course, what was delivered to me during those 7 years was the world religions paradigm, that these are the six religions. And let's talk about these things. So the opportunity to do something so different really fascinated me. But then as I was doing more on Scientology during the MA, I really started getting interested in what's known as free zone Scientology. And very simply, free zone Scientology is an umbrella term for any sort of Scientology that exists outside the institutional Church of Scientology. And the Church of Scientology have got it's especially in academic discourse until very recently, they've had a bit of a monopoly on scholarship on Scientology. Scholars have often used the term Scientology and Church of Scientology interchangeably, which of course we wouldn't simply say Christianity when referring to Catholicism. So there's a need for more nuance there. And there have been some publications recently that are starting to look at the free zone and so on. So that's progress. But I was really interested in these groups. They've got a very occasionally hostile relationship with the Church of Scientology. And what's interested me is this conversation of authenticity that spirals around Scientologist practices. What's authentic Scientology and what's essentially heretical Scientology?
many of my students do dissertations, and not every year maybe, but certainly sufficiently often for me to sort of pick up on it, that Scientology comes up as a topic that they want to write on. And often it's because they've been, for example, to America, to California, and they've actually encountered somebody, whether they've actually done this voluntarily or had someone come up to them and say, let's talk about, you know, our church. And I think that they felt in some ways quite conflicted by this, especially if you're studying religion and you then find that you're caught up in something which you're not quite sure what the contours are of it, really. And that sort of line that's crossed between studying something and actually being converted to something. And I found this fascinating. And the way in which somebody who would, you know, be used to writing essays on something where they feel a sense of detachment was talking about something that they felt was a bit harder to demarcate and a bit harder to classify. Have you ever had any experiences along those lines?
Yes, I have. Well, funnily enough, what you just said about your students reminded me of this. I find in major cities in America, you'll often find Scientologists handing out flyers. And I imagine that's something some of your students may have experienced. So in the early stages of my PhD, so I was well into the research at this point, Victoria and I got married and we went on honeymoon to New York. And as we were walking through Times Square, you know, people in Times Square, they just hand out flyers and I just take them because I'm just too polite to say no. And I got a flyer advertising Dianetics, which is the core text of Scientology. And I didn't notice that it had been handed to me at first. I simply looked down at what was in my hand and I said, oh, Dianetics. Quite excited, of course. And obviously the person who handed me the flyer heard this and she quickly turned to me and said, oh, have you heard of Dianetics? Have you heard of Scientology? Of course, at this point, I was well into my research and Victoria just thought, oh gosh, you poor soul. You don't know what you're getting yourself into. Yes, funny enough, I have heard of Scientology. So yeah, if you do go to the typically touristy places like things like New York or certainly locations in Florida, which is where you'll find their world headquarters, there's a strong chance that you may get a flyer and things like that.
It just reminds me of, I think it was the day that I got my degree result from Lampeter. And that evening, we all went down on the minibus to Carmarthen, to the Lyric Theatre, to see The Piano, the Jane Campion film. And we were there. So I just got my degree like 5 hours earlier. And we were just sort of going, and I was obviously on a bit of a high, got off the minibus. And then this man came over and he was waving this leaflet and he said something along the lines of, have you given any thought to what will happen to you when you die? And of course, and I was, I think at that point, thinking of doing the Death and Immortality MA. And I just got the degree. And it was one of those moments, and I don't know if you've ever had this as well, like when you're in the supermarket or maybe in that experience in Times Square, where you think that you're an expert on something, you're an authority on something, or people, you know, that's the anticipation, the aspiration. But then you find yourself completely out of your comfort zone. At least that's how what my experience was when somebody, and I even had it not too many years ago when I was in a local McDonald's restaurant in Canterbury. And then this chap was asking what I did for a living. And I said, oh, I teach religious studies. And then he was asking me about my relationship with God and what sort of path I'm on. And I suddenly felt really uncomfortable. And it was very interesting because I thought, well, this is my subject. I talk about this professionally. I write about this. This is not a difficult area. But in this particular context, in this particular environment, I felt really awkward because, and I think it was maybe I didn't quite know where he was going with this. And I think he was, you know, wanting me to explain really why I wasn't a practicing Christian or whatever in you know, and did the things that he did. But how did you deal with that situation with the, when you got somebody who's asking you about Scientology, when you know from a different vantage point, admittedly, an awful lot about it?
Well, this all depends on who you're speaking to, because Scientology is such a hotly contested topic. That I even state in my book that I'm not a Scientologist. And I feel the need to point that out because it's not that I'm trying to suggest that, oh, this is going to be a polemic or anything like that. But the way people approach Scientology is that sometimes if you're an academic and you're an NRM specialist who doesn't focus on who doesn't subscribe to the idea of cults and so on, you get the tag of cult apologism. So you've got to be very, so I like to make it quite clear what my position is. So it all depends on who I'm talking to. So often when I speak to people who just don't know much about religious studies, they'll assume that I'm a practicing Christian and I'm you know, exploring my own faith. And then when I mention that my research is on Scientology, they get initially confused, and then they ask me if I'm a Scientologist, because that's the next logical step. And I say no. And then it goes one of both ways. They're either still very confused as why I'm interested in Scientology, and then they feel they can ask the more blunt questions then, because they're not speaking to a Scientologist. But, and I've really found this since Bloomsbury have started advertising my book, there's a lot of anti-Scientologists who will view your work as practically useless and biased to the Church of Scientology and so on, because you're not adopting this cults are terrible, I'm going to take down the Church of Scientology in my work stance. So recently, and I have to admit, it makes me laugh. If they end up listening, they'll say, thank you for making me laugh. My book got flagged on a anti-Scientology forum, and someone said something along the lines of, I have no doubt that this book will be useless crap. And someone else commented saying, I don't know who's going to waste their money on this waste of paper. And it was really interesting, because these are people who've never read my work. Yeah. You know, they've never, but they've made an instant judgment on it based on the fact that I'm adopting the academic religious studies approach to Scientology. So my work is already being dismissed in these circles before it's out there, yeah. Which is fascinating, really, isn't it?
Yeah, because you find these kind of prejudices, which mean, I give an example. I remember when somebody I knew in Lampeter, funny enough, it was before I went there, had written to, you may be too young to remember, but the Points of View, you know, which used to be on...
Terry Wogan.
Yeah, that's right. And it was Barry Took or Anne Robinson in the old days. And I remember in the days before, it's funny looking back, because now that we've got social media, we in a way, Points of View is probably in a sense redundant, in the sense that you can wax lyrical about something that you despised on TV the moment that you've seen it, and you can share it with the world. That's what social mm-hmm. media does. But in those days, if you really hated something, you'd write to Anne Robinson or Barry Took, and you'd say, I am disgusted by last night's EastEnders and all the rest of it. And then what happened is a friend of mine wrote, and it may have been something to do with maybe EastEnders, I'm not sure, but there was a storyline, and it was something to do with a portrayal of homosexuality. It was something along the lines of maybe the way that the character had been portrayed, I'm not sure. Anyway, so she wrote a letter to the Radio Times, you know, making the point that not all people who are gay or lesbian are conform to the stereotypes that the program may have put forward. It was something like it was 30 years ago. Anyway, she then said that she then received an anonymous letter, but it was, I suppose, Lampeter is a small place, and I don't even think her full name appeared in the letter, but it was just her first initial and the surname. Anyway, it got to her because somebody had obviously watched Points of View, disgusted that somebody was effectively suggesting that there may be people who think that homosexuality is okay, and therefore wrote this really sort of letter, assuming that therefore she was gay, and they were effectively telling her that, you know, she was going to hell. Now, this is extraordinary because they'd written a letter to the Radio Times or Points of View or whatever it might have been. So in that sense, it is really frightening. And I'm very aware that I sometimes put film reviews out and I do all sorts of things on social media. But the things I avoid doing, sometimes I can't stop myself. But whenever I put something on politics, inevitably you're going to get people who you think are good friends, people who you or perhaps friends who you know that you have in common, but they don't know each other, and they have this massive argument on your Facebook page, a complete, you know, falling out with each other. Not that they've necessarily met, but they've sort of, you know, that they've. I'm watching these two friends of mine sort of tear each other's heads off because of some disagreement over how they're going to vote or who they think should be standing in an upcoming election. So you're right. It's that there are good and bad things about social media and about the way in which, as you say, in your case, without even having read a word of your book, they were applying various prejudices that therefore meant that they either were, or in this case, were not going to read the book because they already knew what they needed to know and were not going to be educated otherwise.
Absolutely. And it's a shame because, you know, I've always promoted academia to be a conversation, and it's a conversation that should be open to everyone. It's all well and good that we sit in our ivory towers and say, oh, that's very interesting, or this is what I'm working, isn't that very interesting as well? Sometimes I do think if we're not communicating this with the outside world, then what are we doing? I think it's so important that we talk to people who aren't academics and we communicate our work. Because I think that academia can enrich public life. It absolutely can. And that's something to be celebrated. But it's difficult, certainly in NRM studies right now. There's an image problem. And I'm not proposing that I've got the answer to that. But there's certainly an image problem amongst the anti-cult groups about what we do. And who we are, you know, why we study what we study. Some wild accusations are made that certain NRM scholars are funded by the groups that they study, which is an absurd thing to suggest. So it is bizarre. And then there's an element of trying to control work as well, trying to say, oh well, this work is good because this certain scholar has actually said that Scientology is a cult, so therefore they are a legitimate scholar. And then there's another, and they'll take sides in the debate purely based on, well, I suppose you take sides on whether you agree with something, but they'll give certain viewpoints legitimacy because they happen to agree with it. And anything that is against that narrative is just simply bad scholarship.
And you do find it sometimes when the press are interested in getting you to say something that they already know what they want you to say, and they try to get you to say it so they can then wrap it around quotes. And it's like the opposite of what we do in academia, where you're often in search of a good quotation, but it's what somebody has actually said. In this case, I remember it was years ago, and it was about the film Noah, the one that where Russell Crowe plays the patriarch. And it was because somebody had written a book about Noah and the film had come out, so they had this story ready to go, and they needed a third voice. So they needed someone to talk about the film, somebody to talk about the author of this book, and then they wanted somebody who knew something about theology or religious studies so that they could then have this quote that was supposed to be definitive. And I realized afterwards, I did this interview, it was with the Sunday Express, and there was me gabbing away for 20 minutes, half an hour. And looking back, I can see that I was being asked very specific questions, or maybe they were almost like giving me a line and asking me if I agreed with it. And what I think they did was that they said something, and maybe they just about got me sort of saying, yes, I sort of agree with that. And then they put that in as my quotation, which is nothing I actually said. It was just that they knew what they wanted someone, they knew what the story was going to say before it was written. And then all the stuff, all the good stuff I said about religion and film and about the story of Noah and whatever the particular angle was, they weren't interested and didn't even make it. So that I had one line in the Sunday Express for half an hour interview.
Yeah, it's using your expertise to validate a narrative.
Yeah.
So essentially what you said wasn't important. It was your name and your title and your job.
Yeah.
And then it is controlling your work, isn't it? It's using it to present certain narratives. I was once asked to give a little contribution to, I think it was an Evening Standard article was being written about Scientology. The Church of Scientology had been helping out after the Grenfell disaster. I was contacted to answer a couple of questions about Scientology, and my supervisor, I think quite rightly, told me at the time, don't do this. Maybe think about things like this after you finished your research, because I was working with the Church of Scientology at the time in terms of fieldwork and so on. And regardless, and as he quite rightly said, regardless of what I would tell the paper, it would inevitably portray Scientology in a negative way. Well, we can't guarantee that, but based on previous news stories concerning Scientology, you can be pretty sure that it was. And then that would put me in a difficult situation because I would be implicated in an article that I don't necessarily agree with, yeah, and a narrative that I don't promote. And I want to maintain good relations with my fieldwork participants because they, you know, they've been very kind. They've invited me to their churches and so on, their locations. And I don't want to be involved in something that I don't necessarily agree with. So, yeah, it's you've got to be very careful as well, haven't you?
Absolutely. Have you found, two things that come from that. First of all, have you been in that sort of difficult position of needing to be, or somebody trying to convert you into something where you kind of feel that, you know, you need to explain that your approach to this is very professional and academic and that you need to have good relations there. But the idea of, you know, converting is not what you're doing with this discourse. That's not, you know, it's asking you to do something that would ensure that a line was crossed. But also in relation to that, have you ever been in a situation where you've had either a dialogue with, or maybe somebody from the Church of Scientology has read your work, or have you found yourself in an unexpected kind of situation whereby they're receiving your academic work and they might be surprised that what you're doing with it is not what they might be expecting you to be doing with it, having been, for example, a participant?
Yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. I've recently written about this. I had a very interesting fieldwork experience because the, you know, let's be straight here, the Church of Scientology were incredibly welcoming to me. I was taken on tours of the church in London. I then went to St. Hill in East Grinstead, which is their British headquarters. St. Hill has a huge significance in Scientology because L. Ron Hubbard used to live there. He bought the manor, the St. Hill Manor, and they gave me a tour of the manor. They even showed me L. Ron Hubbard's writing rooms that were normally restricted to practicing Scientologists, because if you go as a member of the public to St. Hill, you can pay for a tour. And you know, you can be shown around. Oh, I'm not sure if it is paid, but you can be taken on a tour regardless. But the tour guide playfully said to me, oh, we're giving you the Scientologist tour today, even though I wasn't one. And they showed me some of the rooms where he wrote some of the more esoteric materials associated with Scientology. And that was really interesting. And we had a bit of dialogue concerning the fact that I was simultaneously researching the Free Zone. And I discussed this in the article because the Church of Scientology were understandably a little concerned about how they were going to be presented in relation to the Free Zone. Because as far as the Church of Scientology is concerned, these Free Zone Scientologists are not just lesser Scientologists, they're not Scientologists. What they are doing is not Scientology. Scientology is, according to them, precisely what L. Ron Hubbard wrote down in the books. But of course, books are always open to interpretation. But they promote what's known as standard tech, the tech as L. Ron Hubbard intended it to be practiced by all Scientologists. On a side note, there's a really interesting conversation here where there's many Free Zoners who say, actually, no, we have standard tech and the Church of Scientology has corrupted it. So they're accusing the Church of Scientology of being heretical. But that's a side issue anyway. They don't have the best relationship. And as I've mentioned in my article, the church were keen to read drafts of my work beforehand to make, in their words, you know, to make sure that they weren't misrepresented and so on. And I can understand their position. But when I spoke to my supervisors about this, they said, we need to be very careful here because this has to be your work. And it has to be uncompromised in a way. You know, you can listen to what the church say about the Free Zone. They can say whatever they want about the Free Zone, and I will write that they told me these things about the Free Zone. But we also have to make sure that my work is my work, that it isn't controlled by another party, and that I'm not changing certain aspects. So I had to say to the church, look, once the work is complete, it'll be done. You can read it. You can write a response to it. You can criticize it. You can analyze. You can do whatever you want with it. That is good public, that is good academic discourse. You are more than welcome to be involved in the conversation. But we have to make sure that the work is still my work. I mean, at the end of the day, the thesis is a document to be examined to show that you're a researcher. So it has to be your work in your control. And they... that's when my fieldwork stopped. I didn't get invitations to the church since then. They clearly weren't particularly happy about that. They were, and you know, I can understand that. But I said to them, well, you know, you will see it. And also, please be assured that as a religious studies academic, you know, I'm committed to my methodology. And I'm not a anti-cultist expose writer and so on. But I then saw my participants not long after I'd submitted the thesis. I was presenting at an Inform seminar, and I was presenting on Frees on Scientology, and they really enjoyed my presentation, which I was a little worried about because it was all about Frees on Scientology and so on. But they thought it was really interesting. And of course, they still maintain their position that this is heresy and so on. But they said afterwards, no, that was really good. They still maintain the position of, oh, we didn't want to control your work. We just wanted to proof. And I have no doubt that they meant well. But I think a researcher has to be careful with how they control their work. So, of course, now it's out there. They can read it. They can criticize it. They can do whatever they want and enter the conversation. But I think my supervisors are quite right in insisting that we had to maintain my control of the work.
I completely get that. And in the same way, I think whenever you're working on a project, of course, some of those challenges become part of the work. So in a funny way, your experience, which you may not have foreseen happening before you started writing, ends up becoming part of your methodology or some of the problems that you encounter along the way in terms of exactly how you get around particular obstacles. You know, I suppose it's no different from a situation whereby you're doing this field work and then somebody says, oh, actually, I want to withdraw my consent, or I'm not sure I want to do this because I'm not quite sure what your agenda is. And, you know, and then you then have to sort of like go back to the drawing board, and you might find that of course, it has an impact on your sample.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, I mean, what I experienced was a situation that's very specific to Scientology, because they have a very distinct, you know, these Scientologist groups have a very distinct relationship. So I didn't have much of a frame of reference, but I was aware that some scholars have chosen to share their work and others have withheld it. So I wasn't the first in that regard. And I, you know, for the sake of clarity for anyone listening, I wasn't withholding it for, you know, sinister reasons. It was simply so that it was my work alone and certain elements weren't being changed to fit or to prioritize other agendas.
It's funny, isn't it, when a PhD or a research project ends up becoming a conspiracy theory.
Yes, conspiracy in itself.
You've got a whole new set of genres there. You can turn this into a detective story, or you can turn it into a thriller. It sounds like that there's a lot going on behind the scenes and, you know, around the periphery of the academic work, which in itself is very much, you know, part of your project and your unique input in it. But something else that before we started recording, you were whetting my appetite by talking about something that I always talk about in my interview. Is the influences, the things that we all grew up with. It might be musical, it might be the charts, it might be the sort of things that, you know, as an academic, we're often associated, like you, people will say, oh, he's the guy who writes on Scientology, and, you know, that's inevitable. But I'm guessing that there may be other things that neither the people in the Church of Scientology, maybe not even your own students or colleagues are aware of. And one thing that I've learned in doing these interviews is that people often have a hinterland, which is not really the hinterland. That the academic work might be the hinterland. The really important stuff is the stuff that you grew up with, the gigs you go to, the records you buy, the films you watch. And do you have any sort of similar experiences?
Oh, gosh, yes. So in the I grew up in the 90s, and I was a video game kid, loved video games. And I was aware of what was happening in the charts at the time, but I wasn't interested at the time, interestingly. I've since gone back and I've appreciated so much of what was going on, but so many people I know have an embarrassing first record that they vault. Not that I think anybody should have guilty pleasures, but people will say, oh, you know, this is my first album, this is my first album. I was a retro kid because I started getting into music at the age of 10, and my first band were Queen. And at this point, Freddie Mercury had passed away about 8-9 years.
Yeah, 91. My first term at university, actually.
Oh, really? Freddie was gone. So I didn't grow up with the new Queen records coming out. I didn't have that feeling of picking up a brand new Queen record and thinking, what's on this? But my dad had. So my dad was a diehard Queen fan. And interestingly, I didn't get into Queen because my dad was into Queen. He didn't force them on me. Just one day, I just fancied listening to them. So I asked him if I could borrow a CD. And then as the months went by, he noticed his CD collection got smaller and smaller because I was sneaking to his collection and taking one and taking one. And I think for about a year, maybe even 2 years, I listened to nothing but Queen. It was all Queen. And from there, I spiraled into being this retro kid when in the early 2000s, a lot of my friends in school were listening to things like new metal and stuff like that. But I was listening to The Gem or The Undertones or The Buzzcocks. I really like that late 70s punk new wave period. Sex Pistols, Talking Heads. I was really into that stuff. So I was the kid in school who was listening to the old bands, as it were. And then that started to change. I started to then pay attention simultaneously to old and new music when in 2003, The Darkness released an album called Permission to Land, which was a gateway to modern music for me because it was a modern new album but harked back to an older style. And then in 2004, Green Day released American Idiot, which I still think is their masterpiece. And then I was involved then in modern music. I was paying attention to what was coming out. And at this point, I was then very diverse because a lot of people I knew, in school, you had to be listening to the cool new stuff. It wasn't cool to be listening to the 70s stuff. I kind of went against the grain there. But I'm proud to have done so because my breadth of music that I had to choose from was so much richer. And particularly with Queen, I mean, Queen are my musical DNA almost. Everything that I like about music, you can find in Queen. And while I've discovered new artists and so on, that's still quite the foundation of what I like in music. And then I've got records then that are particularly pertinent to certain periods of my life. And so on. We then get to 2006 when I was in sixth form and I discovered My Chemical Romance and they released an album called The Black Parade. I recently heard them be described as the Nirvana of their generation, which I think is quite a nice way of putting it. That was a life-changing record for sure.
Yeah. And do you find that you're still listening to that same music now? Has it carried forward with you? Are you listening to do you still listen to Queen? How eclectic is the musical interest today?
Yeah. It's particularly eclectic now. Yeah, I still listen to Queen. I religiously. And I listen to other stuff like Leonard Cohen and Kraftwerk. I'm not just a rock and roll guy. So yeah, those are still there, and I've kind of got three acts that are my core favorites. So I've got a large batch of favorite artists, but the three are Queen, My Chemical Romance, and then Sparks. And with those three bands, you can kind of see me going through my teenage years almost, because then my Sparks obsession really started while I was in Trinity, funnily enough.
And was that something shared or was that something that was very much, you did it on your own and other people thought, oh, I have no idea what you're listening to? Or was it something that you could really find? Was there a community of like-minded friends or was it something that was a bit more solitary?
Well, with My Chem, the Black Parade became a phenomenon. It sold millions of copies and everyone was into it. So there, people were talking about them. When I discovered Sparks, Sparks are very much my story of Sparks is testament to the power of YouTube, because I discovered them on YouTube. I watched them perform. And the amount of, you know, they say, oh, you put stuff on YouTube, it takes money away from the artist. The amount of money I've spent on Sparks after watching them on YouTube is quite substantial. So for any listeners who aren't familiar, Sparks are an art pop band consisting of brothers Ron and Russell Mayle. They've got an illustrious career, and they have the status of the cult band, so to speak. Fans of the band almost treat them like a secret. They're our thing, they're our band, because they don't have that huge mainstream appeal that something like Queen has. So there is this close-knit community of fans, especially online. So I had to go on the forums, the Sparks forum and so on, to speak to people who knew about Sparks. My mum had a copy of their propaganda LP from 1974, and she told me to go and listen to it. Once I discovered them, she told me to go and listen to it. And that's then when I then came back and said, oh, do you know, not only are Sparks still going, but they're really awesome. And so we were listening to their new stuff, which my mum absolutely loved as well. But yeah, there wasn't a scene surrounding Sparks that was accessible to me. And a lot of younger fans are now finding Sparks in recent years, and they have social media and so on that makes it a lot easier these days, and streaming and so on. So Sparks for me is everything pop music should be. They're challenging, they're exciting, and there's almost an aggression to what they do. They've just released their 25th album, and what excites me about them is that stuff isn't just as good as what they were doing in the 70s. It's arguably better. They have a drive, this creative drive, to continuously push themselves to not be doing the same thing they were doing in the 70s, to be creating new records and fresh sounding records, records that you could put on and think, these are 30-year-old guys just, you know, using cutting edge technology to make these fresh songs. And that inspires me so much because they're in their early 70s now. So, and I've seen them live so many times and their energy astounds me. Because I've been to their gigs and the next day I've got a sore back because I've been stood up for hours in the queue waiting to get in. And they're just bouncing around the stage, making it look effortless.
Yeah. Did they have a female in the band? Because the song I know is This Town Ain't, is it a big enough for the two of us?
Or? Yes, that's right. So yeah, This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us was their big chart hit. I think what you're thinking of though, they had a female drummer in the early 90s.
Right.
And they had a bit more commercial success in the early 90s. They released a single called When Do I Get to Sing My Way, which was a big hit in Germany. And they had Chrissy Hayden on drums, and she was very striking. She had a very, she used to wear long black gowns on stage and stuff. So she almost became a third member of the band almost during that period, because they always work with other musicians and so on. Fortunately, more and more people are getting to know of them of late. They did a collaboration album in 2015 with Franz Ferdinand. And it's a really great record. But of course, for a lot of people, especially Franz Ferdinand fans who are quite young, this was their first exposure to Sparks. And I imagine Sparks were quite challenging for a lot of them because they, you know, a lot of people do find them very weird. But I noticed a lot more younger people at Sparks gigs after the collaboration album, which is really interesting. And they're able to use social media now to appeal to young people so much more.
Yeah, I mean, are there people then who followed them in the 70s who were still very much doing that now? Have they? I mean, Fleetwood Mac is the other obvious example of a band who, you know, from the 60s onwards, they had hits in each decade, but they all sound very different. Think of Albatross in the 60s with the big album from the 70s, or the hits that I grew up with, like Little Lies and Big Love in the 80s, which, you know, you wouldn't think it was the same band. And of course, in many cases, they did change personnel over the years. But is it the same with Sparks?
The challenging thing with Sparks is that they have flown from genre to genre. And they've recently had a documentary made about them by Edgar Wright. And he did an interview recently where he said that the first time he heard Sparks, he heard a song called Beat the Clock. And it was on a 70s collection album, which is, and Beat the Clock is an electro song. Because at this point, Ron and Russell Mayall were a synth duo. And they had the template that then the Pet Shop Boys essentially copies and went on to have great success with. So he knew that song. And then a few years later, he discovered This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us, which is more glam rock and so on. And he thought, is this the same band? It's got the same name, but they sound completely different. So that is something that keeps me coming back to them, because you don't know where they're going to go next.
Yeah, and the best, I mean, you find this with lots of artists who, if they're going to last the course, they have to, well, do two things. They have to take the audience with them through the generations, but also they have to actually do something that is going to not exclude the contemporary audience. I mean, in a different sort of genre, Cliff Richard has obviously done that because he lasted so many decades. And whether you like him or loathe him, he is somebody who proved that it is possible to be versatile. And not many of his contemporaries were able to do that. Certainly those who are still alive, you know, they're not performing on, you know, on the same sort of circuit that he is. So that's interesting. And it sounds as though, you know, in research terms, like almost like a research project, you know, the way that the band Sparks have evolved and the fact that it's not your generation at all. I mean, the Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us was 74, which is the year after I was born. So it's not even my generation. And yet I had no idea that they were still performing. When you mentioned Sparks, I had to think, is he talking about the same band? But clearly it is. But
yes. That's the crazy thing, because I feel like in a lot of ways they are my generation, because they've released records during my teen years, during my undergrad years, and throughout my adult life. I've looked forward, you know what I was saying about how with Queen I never got the chance to look forward to a new Queen record. I can look forward to a new Sparks record. It's the quality of what they do nowadays that excites me. Obviously I love the stuff from the 70s as well, but the fact that they're still challenging themselves is really great. They what you were saying really struck me now about taking an audience with you. In 2002, they had a bit of a creative rebirth almost. They released an album called Lil Beethoven, which I really recommend everyone get. It's an album so good that I got the logo tattooed on my arm. It's that great. And what they do there, they took pop music and they said, okay, we're going to completely deconstruct it and we're going to build it from the ground up. So you're essentially listening to them create a genre on this album. It's orchestral, it's got all these strings, and there's something hypnotic about it. It's almost listening to electronic beats, but through classical instrumentation. And they use repetitive lyrics throughout those loops. So it strays away from verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, finish the song. There's some songs that will use one line throughout the entire song, but the music and the instrumentation changes along while that line is being repeated. And it is a very challenging listen. It's not overly challenging either. It's not, I wouldn't say it's inaccessible. Like sometimes I listen to some avant-garde music that I think, oh, that's just too inaccessible. It's still pop music, but it's doing something new with pop music. And what was really striking about that record was at the time it was their 18th. And they did something that could have just totally alienated their fan base. And as a cult band as well, cult bands don't want to alienate that following, because that following is their bread and butter. They're the ones who are still buying the records, still coming to the gigs. Radio play isn't what it once was, for example. So they took that gamble. And, you know, yeah, some people didn't like it. Some people said, oh, you know, it's not for me. Largely, though, people embraced it because, in my opinion, it was a creative success. And from then on, they've been in this golden era for me. And what's been nice for me is that I've been there for that. I've been looking forward to the new records, going to the concerts for those tours. So in so many ways, I feel like they are my generation in that I've grown up with it happening. At the same time, they just happen to have this massive backlog of material that was there as well.
No, it's an incredible archive, and it sounds like it's very much the soundtrack to your life, but it's also the pre, the present, and the future, because you've got the expectation of stuff to come and the unknown and all the exciting mm-hmm. stuff that they're going to do. But also you can go back in time to a time before you had even heard of them, that they predate you, and that you've got this gold mine almost that you're able to work your way through.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And for anyone listening who thinks, I may check them out. Obviously, you've got streaming nowadays and everything is just there. But what I really enjoyed in my time in Trinity was I would buy a couple of Sparks albums every 2 or 3 months. And I would just listen to those two albums and really enjoy those albums before then moving on to another one. I worry that if I'd got into Sparks now and I was able to just stream everything on Spotify, it would be overwhelming. And I wouldn't be able to focus on each individual record for what they were doing at the time. So if anybody is thinking of looking them up, try that approach of just one or two albums at a time. And I talk about them on Twitter all the time. I always recommend where people should start and so on. But as you were saying, you know, these media figures, they can influence our thinking as academics. And in terms of what I do as a scholar, you know, I've got inspirations within academia. You know, you were saying that you find that sometimes you'll emulate Paul Badham. And so on. And yeah, I've got my scholarly influences. Of course I have. But I've also got influences like Sparks who inspire me to look at the world in a slightly different way. They're known for their strange appearance and unusual lyrics. But ultimately, their lyrics are all about people. And they're all about, often the songs will be about something very mundane. And they'll present it in a very cinematic way. Like This Town Ain't Big Enough for Both of Us. That's a song about being scared about asking a girl out. Yeah. But it's got these wild cinematic images. They're both film buffs as well, which I'm sure you'll appreciate, Chris. And they'll put this imagery into their work. And the way they constantly challenge themselves to do better on the next thing, that the next record will be even better. That's something I try to put into my own work, that I think, okay, I'll write something better next time. I'll try and think of the world a little bit differently next time. And they're not academics, but they do have that influence on my work.
And in terms of how you actually used to get hold of their albums every few months, were you ordering them, or were you actually physically, you know, say going to a store in Swansea, for example, and buying them? Well, because for me, the pilgrimage is so important. I mean, I've traveled. I mean, I do it now, obviously not during lockdown, but to the cinema. But it's that sense of if something's an occasion, you don't want to just press a button and watch a film. It's too easy. You want it to be arduous. You want it to be something that is that it's a proper, you know, you've earned it. And I would be interested to know if you did the same thing that I used to do when I was at Lampeter and at Carmarthen, which was looking forward to those weekend trips on the bus or, you know, on the train, and actually, you know, going around all the different shops looking, you know, comparing, contrasting which one of these places shall I, you, so different in today's world when a lot of these stores no longer exist. Roland's in Swansea is a place I used to go to an awful lot. But where did you get the material from? Where did you buy the albums?
Yes. Now, this was the challenging part with Sparks, is particularly some of their 80s output. Commercially, it got nowhere in the UK. And they're a band that found success in other places around the world during different time periods. So I bought a selection at HMV. And so on. But some I had to get online. And I just had to. I was never going to find some of these records on the shelf in Swansea, say. But I completely agree and understand what you're saying. In recent years, I've started listening to vinyl. And there's just something so lovely about the materiality of it. That feeling of, oh, well, I'm not going to put something onto stream in the background. I'm going to make the effort to put this record on, to put the needle down. And then 20 minutes later, I'm going to have to get off my seat and flip it over. It forces you to listen to the music. And but both Victoria and I find that it's so much more exciting to buy vinyl when we find it in the record store. And we think, oh, yeah, we really want this album. And yeah, we could go online. We could find it online. But sometimes we'll just think we'll get it when we find it organically. And then when you do, it's the stimulating process of purchase, isn't it? There's some interesting writing out there from a psychological perspective, which is beyond me, but that's really interesting about how we are stimulated by the thrill of buying something. And I think that sometimes ties into finding this album that you've been looking for so long in a record shop. And that is definitely lost in the streaming age. Absolutely.
Yeah, because it's too easy, because I remember the days when you'd watch something at the cinema and it would be 6 months before you could rent it. A film wouldn't be available to rent. And then another 6 months again, so 12 months after its first cinematic release, before you could buy it in Woolworths or HMV or wherever. And so sometimes I'd be at the cinema thinking, oh, I'd love to own a copy of this film. And I think, oh, right, next year, you know, I'm looking for it. It sounds ludicrous now to think that to own a copy of something, you'd be waiting, or if you really liked it, you'd buy maybe an ex-rental copy, which of course the risk then is that other people have watched it and it may not be pristine quality. But you would do that. And throughout the 90s, that was my experience. It was just the way that we did things. It sounds absurd now. Quite simply, you want to watch something, you press a button and you watch it. And often you watch it in wonderful high definition experience. And of course, in that sense, there are many advantages. But it was always the journey that mattered. I wasn't interested in somebody just, you know, like channel hopping. Oh, I'll just see what's on and we'll just watch whatever casually is on. There has to be a sense of agency involved, and there has to be a sense in which you're in control of that process. And if it means that you spend an entire day looking around some shops, well, it's a nice counterpoint to work when maybe you're sitting in an office all day. So you're actually doing something you feel that, you know, the result of that is that you're going to end up watching, you know, the film that you've been looking for, and you deserve it. You've gone to that effort. You've gone that extra mile because it's meaningful to you. And I think in a streaming age, many advantages, you can just press the button and it's there, but the magic, I think, has been lost.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And when from going to these Fox shows, for example, I've met a lot of fans who are my age, but they've discovered them a little bit later than I did. They discovered them in the streaming age. So I'll say to one of them, you know, how long have you been listening to Fox for? And they'll say, oh, about 6 months. And at this point, they've heard everything. I think, gosh, it took me well over a year to get through that catalogue. Yeah. But they had it all at the click of a button. You know, they listened to everything within a few days. And I don't know, I used to be excited. Sometimes I'd have to import one of their albums. Interestingly, now that they've had a bit more commercial success of late, it's much easier to get these records now. But some of them were a real challenge in the late 2000s. I'd have to wait about a fortnight or so for them to arrive. And then there was the excitement of the day when you finally heard the thunk of the CD hit the ground through the letterbox. Yeah. Oh, it's here. And then I'd spend a couple of months listening to that before moving on to another one.
Yeah. No, and also I think what you're talking about there is exactly the same sort of approach to research as well, that you cultivate something, you let it breathe, you're aware that this is seismic stuff, that this is something that is groundbreaking and you want to use it. And in that sense, you don't want to just rush through it. It's actually something that needs to, you know, if it's a life-changing piece of work that you're looking at, and maybe you're doing a PhD on the back of a particular text or a movement or a tradition or a film or whatever it might be, then in that sense, you know, you need to have all the right sort of apparatus around that you don't, I suppose it's the equivalent of a race where you don't want to run too fast at the beginning and then towards the end you run out of steam and you can't complete the race because you're exhausted. You have to pace yourself. And I think that whether it's good research or good music, if it's going to carry you through for your whole life, if it's that good that you know that it's not ephemeral, then in that sense you're happy to take your time over it, and it's always going to be there for you, and it's something to look forward to at the end of the day, or maybe even at the beginning of the day.
Yeah, and you relish it as well, don't you? I'm going to use Sparks as an example again. When they did the collaboration album with Franz Ferdinand, that was, I remember they promoted it, they made it streamable online the week before it was released on a certain website. And I already had my LP pre-ordered. I thought, no, I'm going to wait until I get the LPs. Then the first time I listened to it, I put the record down on the turntable. I looked at the artwork. I read the lyrics. And it was just so much more immersive and rewarding than simply, oh, it's online this morning, apparently. I'll just listen to it now. There was definitely that ritual element to it. And that's so special, I think.
Yeah, because I used to grow up listening to the radio an awful lot, or still do, I guess. But what I would do is if there was a song I really liked on the radio, of course, then I'd buy it. And it's interesting that you'd hear it on the radio, and maybe you'd hear it multiple times on the radio, but you needed to have that physical transaction to almost substantiate that pleasure. So it was a way of concretizing something that really meant something to you, that you actually had it in your hand, whereas it was great to have it on the radio and the excitement when the DJ would play that, or you'd listen to the charts on a Sunday and it would be number one or whatever. And there'd be that, but you also needed to have the concrete version of that. So It needed almost the two in hand. So great to have a streamed copy of something, but also having the hard copy with the text, with the lyrics, with the photograph, the images, all the information that you were just mentioning there. That is so much part of the equation.
Yes. Yeah. And part of it as well is how a band chooses to present themselves. You know, the artwork is part of the presentation of the album. And sometimes that can be lost. And I think it's a shame when that is the case. So someone mentioned in the past that all the artists I'm into are very visually striking. And I think the visual side of music is actually a lot more important than some of your old music heads will suggest this. Oh, you know, it's not about appearance, it's all about the music. I'm not suggesting that artists have to be good looking, but the way they present themselves on stage, the way they look, and that is a crucial part of the experience of enjoying a band. Back to Queen, for example, you know, with Freddie Mercury, it wasn't just about that incredible voice. It wasn't just about those songs. It was about the way he presented himself on stage, you know, that larger than life personality. That is absolutely crucial to what Queen was.
And you think of Live Aid in that sense. And one thing I really enjoyed about the film Bohemian Rhapsody is that it took me back to that Saturday in July 1985 when I saw Live Aid. I was only 11 or 12 at the time. And he really electrified Wembley Stadium. And you could really see that he managed to get everyone, all the 70-odd thousand people in that stadium, together at the same time in synchronicity to clap. And to Radio Gaga and all the rest of it. And it was just one of those moments where whatever your thoughts about the music, it was the appearance. It was very much the way in which he was able to, you know, be a flamboyant figure on a stage where, you know, I guess there was the big screen. People in the back might have been able to see the screen. They certainly couldn't have seen Freddie, but they all would have felt that, you know, at one for those 15 minutes or so that he was on stage.
And of course, in the States, there was another stage in Philadelphia, I think.
Yeah, the JFK Stadium, yeah.
That's it, yeah. And everyone there were doing the clap, clap to Radio Gaga. And he wasn't even in the same country. But he still had that way of connecting with an audience. And you find out with the other artists I listen to, My Chemical Romance, for example, every record they released, and hopefully now that they've reformed, there'll be another record, but every single one was a concept album, and the band would look completely different with each album. Yeah. And the outfits were part of the stage persona, the story they were telling. And I love stuff like that. And as you could probably tell, I love a bit of theatre. I love my music to be in your face, really. I've always been a bit of a frustrated musician, really. I know we touched on before we started recording about things we would do if life worked out differently, you know, what we'd love to do. And I even said to Victoria the other day that if I was in a band, I would rather play a gig and everyone in the room hate us than be indifferent. Because at least I know that if we went down on stage and we caused a reaction, whether they didn't like what I was wearing or the sound I was making, whatever, that for me is better than being forgotten. And sometimes, I go to a lot of gigs, I'll see so many support acts that I then just don't remember the next day. That would be the worst for me. I'd rather have made an impression and it'd be a bad one. Because it's got to be interesting. That's what I like about stuff like Sparks. You know, that some people do find them a little bit too weird, a little too strange and so on. And, you know, that's fine. Some music just isn't for everyone. But at least they provoke a reaction. And I admire that. Maybe I admire that in my work as well, as long as I provoke a reaction.
Well, in a sense, you're doing the right subject in that sense. Back to what you were saying earlier, that you know, even without reading your work, people are already telling you what they think about it. So at least in that sense, you're not being ignored. I think you're onto something there, because the worst thing, I guess, I mean, it's like sometimes with politicians, it's the same. People either love them or hate them, but there's never anything in between for the love hate figures, because you know, Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson or whoever, Tony Blair, people either really like them or people don't tend to be a bit in between about them. They generate a very clear response. And I think the worst thing sometimes is to be a bit of a nobody, to be a bit of the good thing about Spitting Image in the 80s, which I remember, I know it's back now, but growing up watching that in the 80s and 90s, is that if you had a Spitting Image puppet made of you, then you felt that you were made. It was the equivalent of being in the mafia and being a made man. You know, it was like, oh, you've made it into the big time. People in the school playground would be talking about you. And the worst thing I would imagine, would you rather be pilloried and made fun of and, you know, on Spitting Image, or not appear on Spitting Image at all? And the people like the Edwina Currys and others who, you know, would be watching the program, they just wanted to watch themselves. They didn't care how they were portrayed so much as the fact that they were important enough. Yes, they made a sufficient impression to break through, to have a puppet made of them and somebody actually doing their voice. That's the big time.
Yeah, and I find that with impersonators as well. I remember John Colshaw was once saying that how, you know, sometimes people just don't like the impression that you do of them, but at least you're worthy of being impersonated. And, you know, as you're saying, you definitely find that with politicians nowadays. Regardless of political leanings, everyone's got an opinion on Boris Johnson, say, or Jeremy Corbyn. In my experience, none of those views are indifferent. There is an opinion one way, and you will get that opinion from everyone. I guess that's the joy of us doing religious studies as well, is that everyone's an expert in our area, aren't they? Everyone's got an opinion on religion. I remember when I started in Trinity and Stephen Gregg said that not everybody has an opinion on molecular biology, but every bugger's got an opinion on religion.
No, you just made me think of a friend of mine at Lampeter in the early 90s who lived in Hull, I think, or Grimsby. And she worked in a fish factory, and she was so sick of telling people what she was studying. I think her degree was religion, ethics and society. But as soon as she said the word religion, somebody would sort of let rip and sort of say, oh, you know, what a waste of time, or I'll tell you my problems with religion, etc. And in the end, she said she couldn't deal with this because she was getting it all the time. So when people then said to her, so what are you doing? Because a lot of them, I think she was saying that she was at university, many of them hadn't been to university. So in that sense, it was a sense of, why would you do that? It wasn't the opportunity perhaps wasn't there for her. It was a summer job. For them, it was their full-time job. So there was a bit of suspicion about this interloper who's just doing this just to sort of make money to go and, you know, have a wild time in Wales. And what was interesting is that she said after a while, when they had asked her, what are you doing? She'd say, humanities. And she said then that they would just shut up because they were like, oh right, yeah, whatever that is. But of course, religion, you're absolutely right, was a word that was causing all manner of responses and antagonisms and fueling all sorts of stories that sometimes you really don't want to be on the receiving end of.
I found of late that I'm describing myself as a sociologist of religion to people, mainly because I use my PhD is essentially a sociological work. But also I find that for people who aren't aware of what religious studies is and the politics between theology and RS, sociology is something a little bit more tangible. It's a subject that, even if they don't understand what sociology is, they're just aware that it's a subject. So I would say, oh, I do sociology of religion, and it avoids the eyebrow raising moment you get when you say religious studies.
No, I think you're right. And we need these strategies so that when you're in the supermarket, as opposed to when you're in the lecture theatre, you give an answer that perhaps is more suitable for that particular environment. So you don't find yourself, as I often do, on the defensive and trying to explain something that it's almost irrelevant because you're just not in the right place at the right time to talk about the very things that matter. And I think it's just like with all things in life, you know, there's a difference between being at a gig around fans or at a book signing and meeting your hero to actually being in the supermarket or to be, you know, when you sort of need your anonymity. And I think sometimes it's about knowing those differences that just ensure that you respond appropriately to the particular environment in which those negotiations, those conversations are taking place.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to start to wrap up. You've already actually answered one of my questions, Alad, about whether you'd fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young. But it sounds to me as though you mentioned your need to be in the theatre or your drive perhaps to do something theatrical. Is that something maybe that you crave? Is there another life out there that you could tap into, or a different vocation that maybe could be something that you take up in the future?
Yeah, I would love to produce bands and be a studio engineer. I play guitar. I'm not very good, but I really enjoy playing. I'm not a singer by any stretch of the imagination, and I can't write songs, but I reckon I could make a band sound great. I like the I like discussing production and so on. I'd love to do something like that. In a way, I am doing my dream job in that I had this goal of, okay, I'm going to be an RE teacher. And then I went to university and I was so inspired that I thought, oh, I would love to do this. And now I am doing it. So, you know, it's definitely extremely fulfilling and it is a dream. But I do also think, wouldn't it be great to get a new band in and just sit on the other side of the glass and twiddle with the knobs and so on and help make a really good sounding record?
Yeah, well, it just goes to show that whether you're talking about research or you're talking about a gig, that they're in a way they're interchangeable, because it's about that pride in producing something, whether it's a book or indeed a gig or a record, and actually being able to say, I did that, I accomplished that. It was something that you put a lot of effort into. And then the reward is not the indifference, as we were saying, but actually people then talking about it and rating it, and actually years to come, it's still something that people are talking about as being quite an important seminal moment, and it inspires future generations of readers or musicians or artists to engage with.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I do feel like that with my work, that I want people to read it. I want it to do well. So you can see those influences tapping into what I do then in academia, for sure.
Yeah. And I've got one more question for you, Alad, which is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Ooh, that's an excellent question. And I'm going to go with looking forward. And I don't think I used to be. I think certainly before I moved away from home, I would have been a looking back person. That doesn't mean I don't enjoy looking back, of course. But I'm going to do something really nerdy here. I'm going to quote Doc from Back to the Future. And that is that the future hasn't been written. It's what you make of it. And that's what I enjoy that, making new adventures, discovering new things.
I can't think of a better way to end the interview. A quote from Back to the Future. There we are.
Absolutely.
That is completely on my wavelength. You know, Alad, this has been a wonderful chance to catch up this afternoon. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for being my guest this week.
Oh, well, thank you for asking. Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it as well.